The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30.
John Gibbons has come into the studio to me and he's suddenly asking, is it unbearably hot in here? That, John, is because the air conditioning isn't working properly. See how valuable air conditioning is, how essential it actually is to have tolerable conditions in which to sit.
This is true, Matt. Good evening.
Good evening, John. Okay, the first thing I want to ask you about is, now that we're finally, the temperatures are warming up and we're getting a slightly hotter summer, tell us about a discovery that far from things getting hotter simply since we've had the Industrial Revolution, that actually consistently temperatures and summers have been rising over the last 2,000 years. How has this been worked out?
Yeah, scientists use different methods for tracking global temperature over time. Probably the most famous of those would be the ice cores in Antarctica. They give us an 800,000-year record of carbon dioxide levels. And then scientists can use that to extrapolate the temperature in a particular, but it's not very precise. It's maybe to the nearest 100 years. Now, in more recent times, and by which I mean recent, we're talking about roughly a 2,000-year time frame, scientists are able to use reconstructions, temperature reconstructions using tree rings. And they can use those to actually look back and get a year-by-year and decade-by-decade breakdown on the temperature over that period. Now,
by looking at tree rings.
Yeah, that's right. And first of all, obviously, tree rings. First of all, the reason that tree rings are such a useful, what's called a climate proxy, is that trees, during warm summers, they grow more quickly, so the rings are further apart. During colder periods, they grow more slowly, so the rings are narrower together. So when you slice through, say, a 500 or 1,000-year-old tree trunk, what you're looking at, basically, is a historical record going all the way back. And to an expert, that isn't just, I mean, we all know that tree rings show you the age of the tree, but to an expert, they will also tell you the climatic conditions that obtained at that time. Now, you might well say, Matt, well, hang on, maybe there was a disease in that forest, or maybe this particular season in Germany was a little wet. So what they do is, right across the Northern Hemisphere, they sample thousands of tree rings, including fossilized tree rings, and using those, that allows them to average it out. So they can kind of work out, for example, that a particular summer was warm back in, 735, 736, that level of precision from tree ring records going back that far. And that, again, adds to the overall climate record. Now, obviously, when you're building, these are what are called proxies or climate reconstructions. You use different types of measurements, but the tree rings are probably the most useful one, particularly in the near past. And by the way, when scientists talk about the near past, 2,000 years, geologically speaking, is just the blink of an eye. So in that time, what we know for certain is that there hasn't been a warmer period than there is today in the last 2,000 years.
Sorry, where do you find 2,000-year-old trees?
Well, it's a combination. First of all, of course, you do find trees that are up to 1,000 years old. But in combination with those, they also examine fossilized tree records, particularly found at high altitude, for example, in the Alps, where they're preserved. And they can actually examine those and carry out the same tests. So what they tell us is that we know, for example, through instrumental records, which date back to about 1850, 1860. We have global instrumental records that give us thermometer measurements going back, about 150 years. So we know, for example, that 2023 was by far the hottest in that period.
If the heating up of the globe started 2,000 years ago and has consistently gone on throughout that period, would that not suggest then that global warming is not man-made? That it's not as a result of the Industrial Revolution and the higher temperatures that we were told resulted from the extraction of fossil fuel products?
Okay, maybe just I should clarify this a bit. What that 2,000-year record gives us is a proxy of temperatures. What it tells us is that they had been cooling and warming over that period in no particular pattern, as you'd expect with normal climate fluctuations. But in the last 150 years, particularly the last century, they've begun to rise rapidly. So it isn't that those reconstructions are not saying that it has been warming for 2,000 years. Far from it. In fact, probably for the last several hundred years, we've been in a global cooling phase where there's been a slight cooling off of global temperatures. So these reconstructions, Matt, merely give us physical record evidence to show roughly a 2,000-year record. Now, what we know, for example, is, as I say, is that the current temperatures have no analogue in that 2,000-year period. And we also know, going further back, that, and this again are in global climate reconstructions, that 2023 is the hottest year probably in between 100,000 and 125,000 years. So I guess what the tree records do is they fill in some of the very subtle gaps. They actually allow scientists to look down on a decadal level, where things like ice cores only allow you to do it maybe on a century by century level. So they're an incredibly useful instrument in giving that precise view. They also, for example, allow you to look by hemisphere. So we can examine tree ring evidence in the northern hemisphere, find out how it's behaving relative, for example, to the southern hemisphere.
Okay, let's move on. Tell us about a study published in the Lancet Neurology yesterday.
Yeah, this we've spoken about this before, basically, about the how we know that rising global temperatures are related or correlated, if you like, to health impacts. And this is a new study, and it found basically that the human nervous system, and which I might add includes the nervous system of all vertebrates, because we're all basically wired the same way, but the nervous system is highly sensitive to rising temperatures. So what the scientists have looked at are a series of conditions, including dementia, multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, stroke, and migraine. And they also extended the study to look at psychiatric disorders, which would include schizophrenia, depression, anxiety. And then the analysis basically is that as temperatures rise, hospitalizations related to these conditions are rising with it. Now,
is that not due to increased population, or is this done on a per head basis?
Oh no, this is relatively speaking that, like, against a stable population base, you get more hospitalizations per, you know, cadre. In other words, for every 100 patients, for every 1,000 patients, you get more incidence of flare-ups and hospitalizations. Now, in a way, this doesn't surprise me, because we know, for example, that episodes of severe heat waves, say, think back to the famous New York heat waves in the 1970s and 80s, you got outbreaks of rioting and so on. We know that extremely high temperatures cause human behavioral aberrations. We know this. We know the people basically, what was the mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. This idea that high temperatures affect our psychology. So what this does really is it looks more deeply into it and examines whether in fact there's a neurological basis for this. And the evidence, Matt, from this is that there is indeed evidence to suggest that we can expect people with pre-existing conditions, whether it's dementia or other psychiatric conditions, that we're going to see more hospitalizations and higher levels of illness and I guess this also indicates more treatment is going to be required.
Yeah, but you know, there are people texting in and suggesting that particularly the psychological issues are down to us discussing climate change and global warming, that we're talking ourselves into a depression about it.
Yeah, wish that were the case. In fact, it is a point. The same study found that, for example, a new mental health disorder related to climate anxiety has been recorded. I suppose the issue really is whether you consider a disorder a rational response to people's growing anxiety about the climate. I was thinking about this actually on the way in, and it occurred to me that is it more disordered, Matt, to be anxious about climate change, or is it more disordered to be casual and relaxed about it? I would tend to
be in denial about it.
Or indeed, I think many of the people who claim to be very laid back about it and, oh, it's no problem and this has always changed and that has always changed, if you peel it back a little bit, a lot of these people are actually afraid and they're in denial, and their way of dealing with the denial is to actually brave it out and say to their friends, this is all rubbish, don't mind that guy. But in fact, deep down, a lot of these people, it turns out, are afraid.
Okay. You have consistently expressed doubts about the prospects for the creation of enough sustainable jet fuel to replace the what's used at present to get our aircraft into the air. And it seems that others are now agreeing with you.
Well, that's the thing about me, Matt. You'll always find, give me enough time and others will start agreeing with me.
That's okay. Some of our listeners. There will be holdouts, John.
There will, of course. You can't please everybody. Now, okay, let's first of all get our arms around the size of this problem or this issue, right? Globally, there's 350 billion litres of aviation fuel, Matt, burned every year. Now, put that in weight terms. That's about the equivalent of a third of a billion tonnes of aviation fuel. Now, that, of course, at the moment comes about 99.9% from fossil fuels, from aviation kerosene. Now, of course, the industry is talking up a good fight how we're going to replace these fossil fuels and we're going to have these SAFs, the so-called sustainable aviation fuels. Now, this study had a look at it in some detail and came to the same conclusion that people like myself have been, and that is you cannot simply replace a third of a billion tons of fossil fuels with these aviation fuels. For example, like, what are they made from? Some of them are things like, say, used chip pan oil. Now, you don't really find enough spare chip pan oil knocking around to get a jet aircraft maybe more than a couple of feet. So the idea essentially means that, let me give you a small example. This calculation was done in Britain. Let's say that Britain decided to convert cropland just to fuel its the aircraft operating out of Britain, just those. That would require half of the entire cropland of the island of Great Britain just to feed aircraft. Now, of course, we also know that agriculture is under pressure in Europe and around the world because of extreme weather, because of climate impacts. And the last thing we need to do is to be taking millions of acres of valuable croplands out of production and transferring them over to feed what if effectively is a habit for a very small, very privileged number of people. And as we've often said on this show, maybe fewer than 15% of the world's population have ever set foot on an aircraft. And if you're one of them, you're in a global elite, and we should probably exercise a little bit of restraint knowing that fact.
There's one other thing I want to ask you about. The Climate Change Advisory Council was out this week. I think we eclipsed of Mary Donnelly on the news in relation to this. And it's saying urgent action is required from government if the country is to meet our 2030 electricity capacity targets and stay within the electricity sectoral ceiling. What does that mean?
Basically, it means like all sectors of our economy are supposed to decarbonize by given percents by 2030. Agriculture, for example, has the lowest one at 25%. Other sectors, the mean, by the way, is 51%. I'm not sure anybody's going to make that target, but that was the mean target set. And for the electricity generation sector, that requires, for example, typically we need to be adding approximately 1.6 gigawatts of additional energy renewable energy every year. And to imagine what that looks like, think of the biggest power station in Ireland, say Moneypoint. That's about 900 megawatts. That's a coal-fired station. So you're looking at kind of almost two Moneypoints a year worth of renewable energy being brought on the grid every year. Now, the CCAC pointed out that last year we only managed to bring on 600 megawatts. So we missed it basically by a gigawatt. Now, the issue, of course, at the moment is that we have kind of saturated the easy locations for onshore wind. Now, we are bringing on solar, and it has been surprisingly successful. But really, the big bang for electricity production in Ireland will happen when we get it offshore. Because that's...
And yet people are even objecting to that. You get objections on the basis that it won't look nice to look at, or it won't seem nice, even if it's 10 kilometres, 20 kilometres further out.
That's right. I remember going to a public hearing in Dún Laoghaire a few months ago, and it was a great opportunity for the NIMBYs to have an evening out in a hotel to explain how, if they really peered very, very closely out into Arklow Bay, they might see the blade of a wind turbine, and this might affect, I presume they're worried about their property prices or something, but I think we do need to get real about this. We need to produce energy, we need to produce lots of it, we need to produce it cleanly, and importantly, Matt, we need to produce it domestically on this island.
But isn't the government failing dramatically in this regard, particularly when you have a minister who's utterly committed to it, and yet there has been a consistent failure to get the legislation in place and the regulation, and also the infrastructure that will allow to bring this electricity onshore?
First of all, the whole process is devilishly complicated, and part of the work that's been going on has been to consolidate all the different departments, all the different agencies that have to, for example, that are connected with this thing called foreshore licensing. So you've got all kinds of environmental impact studies that have to be done offshore, and rightly so, by the way. And I do hear a clamour, by the way, for people saying, oh, you know, cut through the planning, skip through that. Generally speaking, if you rush your fences with planning, what you end up with is bad planning and disasters that we then end up years later having to tear down again. So I'm slightly sceptical when I hear people saying, using excuses like, oh, we need to build more renewable energy, so we need to simply short-circuit the planning process. Of course,
and we need to speed it up, John. We have fallen so many years behind. And what's going to happen now is that other countries will take advantage, and that's where the international money from the investment will go into providing wind energy. And we'll have missed our chance. We'll have missed our opportunity. It could be the gold rush for Ireland in wind energy offshore. Better than finding oil in our sea waters. Proper actual use of multiple turbines in the sea and bringing it into a grid onshore and sending it overseas could be an absolute game changer. And we have hidden behind this idea, oh, don't rush the planning for so long. We need to get real about getting this done.
Okay, I hate to agree with you, but I'm afraid I do. Of course, this is our moonshot, getting offshore wind right. We have the best, steady, constant wind resources in Western Europe. And for God's sakes, I mean, of course we've got to do this, and you're absolutely right.
And sorry, I'll tell you as well, I also have heard from various sources, the French and Germans are absolutely fed up with us. They think that there's an enormous opportunity, and as an interconnector from France, we could be sending the electricity back in their direction, and yet we're absolutely messing it up.
Well, that's right. And last year, for example, one of the reasons, ironically, that our emissions profile electricity production was down, Matt, was because we were a net importer of electricity from the UK grid. And you're absolutely right. We're in the process of laying down an interconnector directly to France. At the moment, it looks like the traffic is going to be largely one way. We'll probably be using French nuclear spillover back in Ireland. What we want to have, of course, would be to lay down multiple lines into continental Europe, bypass Britain as far as possible. And we really need to get the finger out, sort the planning.
John Gibbons, thank you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.